The next thing is a discussion with our FCC attorney, John Krigler, who's come. I think we're going to be talking about a few different kinds of things, including obscenity and also questions of calls to action and possibly issues relating to licensing and distribution. But I thought I'd turn it over to John to make an initial presentation, and then board members can pepper him with ignorant questions.
Sounds good. The topic I thought I was going to talk about was the recent decision by the Copyright Royalty Board on streaming stuff, but I'm happy to talk about anything you want to talk about.
Well, why don't you talk about whatever you've prepared, and then when I said ignorant, I did not mean stupid. I mean we don't know things that you know. So after you've told us what you do know, we'll ask you what we don't know.
All right. Sounds good. Actually, there are about five topics that I'll try to cover, all of them superficially, so you all can make me dig deeper. One is this decision that will affect you, will affect the stations, will affect your producers, because it's going to affect streaming rights and payments. The other is a recent decision that we don't yet have the text for, so there's a limited amount I can tell you about the regulation of HD radio. That's something that you'll need to pay attention to, because it's going to give you some new opportunities to reach new audiences with new programming. Filing window.
John, these mics are designed to be pretty dead, so if you could bring that thing right up to you, it'll pick you up much better.
All right.
And point it a little higher.
Turn me into a radio personality.
After all this time, John, at last.
Your own show. Right. This is why, for 21 years, I've been asking for this. No one's ever had me. So the CRB decision, the FCC's HD decision, I just want to mention it. I know you probably have talked about it elsewhere. Filing window. Ursula Rudenberg has been very active in this Radio for People movement that's informing people about an opportunity to file for new non-commercial licenses. Indecency. Payola, there's a recent settlement that I think will give us a useful working model for how you might approach payola problems, and then calls to action or anything else you want to talk about. I did bring along a handout just so I don't have to talk about math. No longer my strength. Because a lot of what went on in the Copyright Royalty Board decision is it's a rate case. So there's 13,000 pages of testimony primarily by economists there that underlie how the board reached its rate decision. Rather than try to take you through that, I thought I'd just tell you 10 things not to like about the decision. Much easier to talk about grudges than facts. So that's what I thought I'd do. And you'll get a sense, I think, of why the decision's important and why you all need to think about how you can intervene in this.
Before you do that, Greg, have the managers been asked to attend this session?
I told them to be here in the morning, but not they didn't realize that it was early. I told them digital or something.
Okay. Well, hopefully we will take the audio of this and give it to them and perhaps ask them to give a listen.
And this will feed into your other rights issues, because this is the economic impact of, you know, basically what you're going to have to pay, particularly if you want to do side channels. And that's the first thing that everybody has focused on about this decision. It's actually the simplest, but to my mind not the most important aspect of it. It's going to increase the cost of streaming about 400% right out of the box for most licensees who stream, who reach more than a minimal number of listeners. The second thing that I think in some ways is equally important is that the new rates will not only apply to your primary channel, but to any side channel. So it really discourages your using side channels to open up to experiment with new programming. You're going to have to pay at least the minimum license for that. So if you are now doing one channel and two side channels, you immediately, even without the rate increase, triple the rates that are going to be owed. So the rates apply are geared to the number of performances. So the more people listen, the more you pay. That's exactly the opposite of the model you're used to in broadcasting. Success is punished in this model. Above a minimum threshold, which I find it's stated in terms of average tuning hours, but I find it more useful to think of in terms of listeners. It amounts to an average of 218 listeners a month. You're right.
No.
218
listener hours.
Listeners per hour on an average on a month.
A monthly basis.
Right. If you exceed that level, you're treated under this formula like a commercial entity. So, again, the board decided that there was a segment of the market that non-commercial broadcasting and streaming could be distinguished from commercial streaming, but only if you were unsuccessful. Then you were treated for purposes of rates. Let me just get through this.
I just want to ask non-commercial. So when I looked at those regulations, what you're saying they're defining as non-commercial is not a 501c3, but determined by a listening threshold.
These are rates they are applying. There are two groups who are at risk here. One are just non-commercial webcasters, pure streamers. And the other are non-commercial stations who are streaming their broadcast signal. These would apply equally to both those groups. It requires your tracking performances. You're not used to that. And it's going to be a record-keeping nightmare to go in and try to calculate every time you play a copyrighted work. But that's what you're going to have to do in order to figure out how much is going to be owed under the fee.
Don't they have an alternative calculation method based on tuning hours?
For now, that's exactly what's being phased out.
Oh.
So there's also now different rates for different formats. So non-music formats get a cheaper rate. That's being eliminated.
The lower rate for talk and sports
is being deep sixed.
Just so people know, it was 12-fold less for sports.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. It was what?
It was 12-fold less. For if your programming was substantially all news and talk, you paid 12-fold less than you paid if it was music.
So what's eliminated? So now it'll be higher or lower?
It's the same as music.
Now there's no separate license for talk or sports. The same license. And it's a particular hardship for news people to do the record-keeping part, because now you're going to have to go in and drag out background music or any music, copyrighted music that's performed, and turn that into a rate. The rates escalate over time. So between now and 2010, they double. The rates are retroactive to 2006, so we're going to have to go back if they apply.
Geez.
And figure out what's been owed for the past year and a half. And finally, for radio stations like yours, the increase in the rates and the fact that the rates vary mean that CPB may no longer be able to pay them. So that's going to have an impact on you and an impact on community radio.
Mm-hmm. It'll shut them down.
So needless to say, there's great concern about this decision. The Copyright Royalty Board, just within the past week, has turned down petitions to reconsider it. So that's eliminated one avenue of possible relief. that doesn't mean that the game's over. An appeal is in the works. New legislation is in the works. There's still an opportunity to talk with Sound Exchange, which administers these, about whether we can reach a different kind of understanding. But those are all uphill fights. Sound Exchange doesn't have a big incentive to give ground. It just got everything it asked for. Legislation, never easy, and particularly copyright legislation, which is complicated. Who knows what your chances are of winning on appeal. Now, Pacifica didn't participate in the rate-making itself, so right now you're not a party, but I think there's a way in which we can get your perspective involved. In the past, NPR has really negotiated licenses for everybody, for all CPB-qualified stations. But they've agreed to let NFCB work with them on these appeals and the legislation. So I'm going to be working on behalf of station resource groups and NFCB and your NFCB members. So you're going to have some input, and I'm going to be able to relay back to you from some inside information about what's going on. So I'll try to keep you apprised of this. This is, you know, high visibility issue. There's a group of small webcasters that are organizing around a site called Save the Net. That's worth tracking. They put out a story every day on what's going on. And I think certainly if by the time we get to some draft legislation, it's something you may want to talk about and keep your listeners informed about, because it's certainly going to have an impact on your own streaming, on audio port, on anything you want to do on the net. So that's one issue, and the news ain't good. More cheerful note. your friend, the FCC.
That's cheerful.
I said more cheerful. It's issued so far only a press release on what it's going to do with HD radio. And so we still don't know much about some of the harder issues, but what we know so far is that till now you've had to go back to the FCC and get what's called an experimental license to do any kind of HD. This is now going to be part of your license. You're going to be able to, once you adopt this HD technology, you're basically going to be able to make up your own minds about how you use your spectrum and how you want to split it up, and how many channels you want to split it into. So there's a great opportunity for you to do over the air what you've been doing streaming and put some new content out there. With those new opportunities are going to come some new, guess what, liabilities, because each one of those channels, if it's carried in a broadcast mode, is going to be regulated as like your existing channel. So the full panoply of FCC regulations are going to apply. The FCC has been talking recently about encouraging broadcasters to let third parties come in and program digital channels in order to diversify programming. That's fine, but of course, you're ultimately, as the licensee, going to be responsible if anything goes wrong. So you'll have some policy work cut out for you there in deciding, you know, whether to convert to HD, when, what the costs are. At the NFCB conference recently, I asked in a session how many people in the room had were operating in HD, and maybe half the hands in the room went up. I asked how many had HD receivers, and maybe a quarter of the hands. There were more people there with stations than receivers.
Oh, my God.
And that remains the problem. We just don't know whether consumers are going to buy this technology. And that's what makes it very high risk for you, even if high impact and high reward. The filing window, you know, I think you all have done a great job in through the Radio for People project in publicizing this. You've been working with grassroots groups in the Midwest and I understand the South now, particularly in the South where there's a dearth of non-commercial broadcasting. This is a great opportunity for you all to help people who may or may not grow up to be Pacifico affiliates, but for the most part don't know anything about non-commercial broadcasting and need help. That window is going to open in October, October the 12th through the 19th, and there's going to be a stampede. One thing you've done in cooperation with a bunch of other national organizations is that we asked the staff, I don't know whether this will work or not, but it seemed like a good idea, to put a limit on the number of applications people could file. One of the problems the FCC had a few years ago when it took in translator applications was that it got 13,000 applications, but 9,000 of them were from two organizations. So, and the low power folks hit the ceiling because they said that's just exhausting the spectrum. All of those could be used for low power stations. So the questions of abuse and speculation and whether or not the FCC's priorities were right froze the whole process. So everything is just gridlocked, and the result is no stations. So we don't want that to happen again. We want this to go forward so that this is the first opportunity anybody's had in 7 years to apply for a new non-commercial station. We don't want a regulatory meltdown. We want this to work. So you will have played a role in that.
And I agree to that?
Not yet. It's before the staff. I've talked with the staff. The staff love the idea because they don't want another mess on their hands. The problem is that they also don't want this to be perceived as an attack on the religious organizations who are the major mass filers. So religion was never mentioned in our letter. After the initial words, pray don't do it again.
Oh, God.
Some of you may have seen that the pale of decisions that Elliot Spitzer negotiated before he became governor of New York got the big press. Record companies paid big money to settle a series of cases that Spitzer brought when he was attorney general. He, in turn, put pressure on the FCC to look at payola issues. A case was just settled involving Citadel. For the most part, you know, what Citadel was doing and what you would be doing, they aren't your problems. But what I'm going to try in the next few days, this just happened, is to see if I can extract from the settlement agreement that Citadel entered into something that would be a workable model for you all. Because what they agreed to do was some training, put some procedures in place, and those have been blessed by the FCC. So that may be a good model for us to look at in terms of how we handle the problem. That's sort of the part of this I had planned, but from here on, felt away.
Okay, when we do this, could we do what we did yesterday with the managers, which is start off with a given topic and stick with that topic till we sort of exhaust the issue and then move to another topic so there's some focus?
Exhaust the issue or the attorney.
Yeah. So who would like to... you want to... Okay. So I guess we'll just start off with whoever has the first question and stick with that topic for a while. I saw Lonnie's hand go up first, so I'll go there, and then we'll pound away on whatever topic he opens up, and then we'll move to the next one. Lonnie?
Yeah, well, you know...
On the mic? And John, were you asking also to raise a question? Okay. See everybody.
John, I just have a basic question. I'm looking through your handout. I'm trying to see what would the rate increases mean for our operations, let's just say a WPFW, which is a music format.
That's hard. In order to answer that question, I need to know how many listeners or how many people are listening to a stream. If you're below this threshold of 218 listeners per hour per month, it may have relatively little impact on you. You're just going to get hit with a $500 minimum license fee, and CPB may be able to pay that. Once you go above that level, the sky's the limit. You got to tell me how many listeners and how many streams and how many performances. You know, this little memo assumes that you're doing about 10 songs an hour, but it could be less, it could be more, depending on the format.
So it's 250 per hour per day, and then you aggregate it to look at the monthly statistics. Is that how it's done?
It's below 218 per hour per month. You're covered by a minimum blank flat fee, and above that, you got to kick into a per performance calculation.
Just quickly, can you clarify? You said streaming. Does that impact archive downloaded archive stuff as well?
No, this is going to be. It's not going to be. It wouldn't cover, for example, podcasting or an on-demand system. Right.
Lisa.
I was wanting to know in terms of
microphone. Oh, sure. Here, I'll share.
Right. In terms of.
We'll do a duet.
Yes. In terms of. If I would have known, I would have practiced my vocals last night. But
I was allowed to go to Glee Club only if I didn't sing.
But in terms of this rate issue, and because I see the Copyright Royalty Board, just saying that that's the board that has established this. And from what my limited understanding, I was saying that the FCC, technically, they're not involved. I know they want to get involved in internet issues, but there's a fight with that. What can, who, in terms of fighting this or challenging this, who are the bodies that we can approach? What are the things that the listener can do? And you mentioned some things about maybe there's a way that Pacifica can get involved in this challenge too. Could you just elaborate on those things a little more? Thank you. And how the FCC would play a role in this, if at all?
Yeah, this is almost totally outside the jurisdiction of the FCC. This is blame digital broadcasting for all this. When webcasting first came along, record companies were terrified, and they remain terrified, that people aren't going to go out and buy CDs anymore. They're just going to download stuff or get it free off the internet. So an act called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was passed that established that people would have to pay a royalty to perform sound recordings, the rights the record companies own. Then we had to figure out what rates would apply. That's actually done by the Library of Congress, of all things, rather than the FCC. And it's created this panel of actually judges called the Copyright Royalty Board in its most recent incarnation. It used to be called the CARP, or the Copyright Royalty Tribunal. But they're folks who take in evidence. Anybody can submit evidence, but it's an expensive process to get involved in these rate cases. You need to provide expert testimony, and it's a long process. So it's mostly the people who perform in there, who participate, are representing large owners of rights or large users. So the big commercial webcasters are there through an organization called DEMA. NPR pretty much represented secular public non-commercial broadcasting, although the college broadcasters submitted testimony, and the religious broadcasters submitted testimony. But it wasn't done, it's almost too big a project to do on a per station basis. It almost has to be done by organizations that represent large groups of either users of music or owners of music rights. Nonetheless, I think we can get involved in this. NPR said they're willing to work on a team basis so that stations feel they have a voice in this. So I'm going to be working with a team of NPR and CPB lawyers to try to figure out whether there's a different license arrangement that we could enter into with Sound Exchange, which collects the money and then distributes it about 50-50, in theory anyway, to the record companies and to the artist. So they still have the ability to negotiate a different license than the one that's been ordered here. In fact, what's being replaced is a license fee that's been ordered rather than one that's been negotiated. The difficulty, of course, is they don't have a great incentive right now to give us a break. They won. So that's going to be pretty tough negotiating, which is why, in order to get any leverage in the negotiations, we're also going to have to appeal this decision and argue to the court that it doesn't make sense and appeal to Congress to overturn this and either set rates or put some pressure on Sound Exchange to negotiate a new rate. None of that's going to happen very quickly. And so one of the issues that's going to remain out there is, you know, what's happening. If these rates are upheld, they're still going to spring back to January 2006. So at some point, if these stand up, there's going to be a large bill to be paid.
Sarv.
In the state of California, in the rate-making proceedings there, if you don't have the money, you can ask for intervenor compensation. And you can show that you contributed towards outcome in a positive way, and then you'll be compensated for it. In these rate-making proceedings in the federal government, FCC, is there any clause where you yourself, as a Pacifica small organization and other organizations get together and you're trying to do some public good and ask for intervener compensation?
I don't know the answer to that question. There's no provision of that sort that I know of. In fact, if there were, I think we would already have discovered it. The people who participated below, I think, would have done a much better job had funds of that sort been available. In fact, one of the problems with proceedings like this is that the people who can create the best record through expert testimony and facts, they win. In fact, one of the problems is that we just did public broadcaster folks just did a poor job. We put in some good testimony, but it didn't have the kind of depth of detail that people who are trying to find a basis for setting a rate, the kind of economic basis they're looking for, it just wasn't there. In fact, to my mind, the biggest gap in the record was that we didn't put in any information about the cost of collecting all this information. And so when the rate board got to that issue, they said, you know, you tell us that there is going to be some cost, but you don't tell us what it is. We don't have any way of quantifying it. So guess what? We don't want to ignore it, but we'll consider that later. After there's another proceeding to talk about costs, but now after the rates are set.
Just one small question. Is there a way now, given the shape of the new Congress, that we can effectively change the legislation a little bit where we can ask, they include in future, the intervener compensation for these organizations? And if you could, you know, keep us appraised of that and how we can help in that direction, I think that would be helpful.
Okay. I think what's already happened is that people are starting to figure out what alliances in Congress we can strike. Vermont Public Radio has gotten to Leahy, who's on the Judiciary Committee. This is going to be a Judiciary Committee matter, for example. So that's a good point. I'll try to I'll explore that and see if there's any potential for it.
Ray, then Mary, then John L. Miller.
Good morning, John. Good to see you. I've been asked to find out what is the impact of all this on live performance.
There's no impact on live performance unless it's streamed. These rates will affect the performance of any performance broadcast or distributed in a digital mode, which is streaming.
Of copyrighted music.
Of copyrighted music. You know, if it's copyrighted music, then it'll be a performance of that work, and that'll click up a performance on your rate card.
Mary.
Well, most of us have been trying to increase our audiences who listen on the net. Sounds as if now we'd be penalized for doing that. Is there a strategy? Should stations try to... Is there another way you can get people listening on the net besides streaming? Like, do we want to encourage everybody to go to the archives instead and listen an hour later? Or is there any way... Because Lisa asked, what can listeners do?
Right.
And I'd like to explore that further, because if there is, we can easily get word out. So
right.
What can listeners do besides not listen until it's archived?
Well, not listening is what listeners do the worst.
That's why I asked the question.
So I wouldn't encourage them to not listen. there are different strategies, and I think, you know, I'm not much of a PR guy, but I what little I know says, you know, don't tap those resources until you know where you want them to go. And I don't yet know whether I don't think non-commercial broadcasting, I don't think NPR or NFCB yet, you know, have a strategy worked out. When we have some legislation, you know, I think it's important to get the word out to constituencies who have congressmen on these committees to pass this legislation, that this matters to listeners, that they don't want to lose their streams. Another approach is to try to, this is much more focused, would be to try to increase the appropriations for CPB so that it can continue to pay these fees. I mean, what CPB is saying right now is, you know, we've got a limited budget. Our budget's like about $400 million, and of that budget, 75% of it has to be distributed back to stations. And so we have a limited amount of money that's available for anything other than the CSG programs. So if you want us to, if you're going to hit us with these huge rate increases, you, Congress, need to, if you don't want to pass new copyright legislation, give us some more money so we can keep public broadcasting on the net.
John, were you going to ask about the copyright stuff, or is yours an HD question? We're pursuing the copyright stuff and the license fee stuff right now, and we'll come back on the HD. So why don't you ask that part, and then LaVarne.
LaVarne after, and don't let me LaVarne leave.
After John.
Don't let me leave decent. I'll feel embarrassed.
Go ahead.
Hi, John.
I want to say something about that too.
I'm John L. Mella. I'm the technical director for Pacifica. When you were talking about second channels earlier, were you talking about the analog subcarriers?
No, I was talking about side channels for streaming.
Side channels for
streaming. Additional channels.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
And again, that's something we just don't. Part of the problem is we, you know, it goes back to the question of what impact this has. I don't think we know. On a station-by-station basis, how many stations or a streaming at all. Now, I guess that's almost 100%. How many are streaming more than a simulcast of their broadcast station? And beyond that, how many have multiple side channels? I mean, some stations have really gone wild and done, you know, very niche programming, done specialty language programming, really experimenting on the net. Those, you know, have four or five of these side channels. The way the current license is written is that you can do as many side channels as you want without breaking this outside the statutory license that you have a coverage for.
But would they look at the sum of all those listeners at this point?
They would look at each channel separately. So each channel would be like another station. It would start off with the minimum fee per channel, and then you would have to track the number of performances.
Okay. What about something like this meeting? If we played no copyrighted material,
right,
it still falls under it?
Even though millions of listeners would love to hear this meeting.
Wait,
no, it would. It's only going to be a performance of a copyrighted work. So unless I break into song here, you're fine.
So,
excuse me, but if you had the bumper music we were playing at the start streamed, which
that
was copyrighted,
that's
music,
right, and that's a real
don't
problem.
Tell them
you're
that,
have
Dave.
To go back and track that and decide whether that's a performance of a whole work or whether it's ancillary and you or fair use and you could ignore it. There are, you know, major headaches involved.
So we have to be really careful how many streams we put out there, because even the base rate could just increase. So if we're doing different resolutions, that's not going to make a difference to them. If, let's say, we're doing 24 kilobits, 22 kilohertz, which is definitely not CD quality, it doesn't make a difference what the quality of the stream is.
It can be a crummy performance, and you still have to pay.
Just so other board members know, what John's referring to is the fact that when they put in the streaming at many of the stations, they put it in at low bandwidth,
in
the view that would help protect them against such claims in the future. And what we're hearing is even that so giving our listeners an inferior listening experience did not protect us.
Because otherwise you'd be doing fine.
What if we encrypted it? What if let's say that we're going to a small audience, Pacifica has KU streams, which are not for the public, but just for our affiliate stations so that they can rebroadcast our content.
Right.
If we encrypted that, would that protect us?
That's a good question. It would have to actually, and I think the answer, unfortunately, is probably no. I looked at it a little bit. I worked with PRX, which has a system where stations or anyone can go on and listen. They had the same strategy. They degraded the signal. They had limited number of users that had access to it. And we teamed up with the Berkman Center at Harvard, and the answer they came back with as to your very question is that would that still be a performance was probably.
Okay.
So the question is how many people have to listen for that to be a public performance? And you can understand why that number is pretty low. I mean, this room here, if it were performed, that'd be a public performance.
What if we had? What if a server somewhere else, like in the world, let's say Norway or something like that,
right,
was repeating our stream? Are we liable for that repeat, or is?
No, this is. I think this is going to be. The United States doesn't yet regulate intellectual property worldwide, although it has ambitions in that direction.
So that might be a way that we just had one server and somebody else decided to provide us bandwidth. That we don't have any liability there.
The BitTorrent approach. LaVarne?
Thank you. I guess this is a surprise that maintaining your same listener base and increasing it was a good strategy. But the question I think a lot of people have touched on is that, you know, with perhaps, I guess, less than 2 years until this administration will be replaced, hopefully, in terms of lobbying and trying to raise questions, I know you said in terms of talking with Leahy of Vermont, right. What strategy can Pacifica use to try to string this out so that these will not be put in place permanently?
My best hope for what's going to come out of this team approach is that public broadcasting will be able to tap all the resources it has. I mean, NPR is pretty good at lobbying. They do it professionally, but they're not the extent of the world. So once we get some legislation that public broadcasting can get behind, I think it makes sense to tap all the resources we can. We're going to look to who from Pacifica stations is on or on what committees and try to get to them.
I've got a couple things I wanted to say and ask. One of them is that, you know, you can talk about lobbying, right, but you're more effective lobbying when you have some leverage and power. And one of the goals of the licensing and distribution stuff we've been talking about is if there are significant streams of content that don't fall under these regulations, it puts pressure on the copyright world to respond to that. I mean, you prevent the abuses of a privatized system by having a public system that competes with it. You limit the cost of water, privatized water, not by lobbying people who are elected by water company contributions, but by having a public works system and a public water system that provides services cheaply. The other thing is, as we think about what we're going to do for ourselves as an institution, we also have to think about the value to larger social movements of our fighting for the rights of everybody, not just large broadcasters, and the impact that has on potential funders who will support us if we are fighting for broader rights than just ourselves. And so, you know, it's just a comment that as long as we agree to not do the work that gets us out from under exclusive control of copyright, I think we're always vulnerable. And so I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
No,
but then I have a couple
of questions.
I agree.
I mean, one of the things that I think you all bring to this is that you have connections with more than one community out there. I mean, one of the communities that you're a part of course, is the non-commercial broadcasting community, and that's the one, you know, I know the best. But you also have connections with other progressive organizations, with labor interests, with other political constituencies, and you may well want to think hard about how you can form coalitions with those groups. There are going to be multiple groups who are, I think, forming around this issue. As I mentioned, the one that's the sort of, there's a big commercial group. There's another group that's much more amorphous called the Save the Net group. You may well want to take part in that group and track what it's going on and see whether there's something we can do with them.
And the other big role is just educating our publics on these issues, because I think a lot of them don't understand the extent to which it's going to limit civic media power. And we should be doing that. So I have more to say, but I'll wait. Lisa?
I'll just ask me a moment, because this would apply to... This would apply to not just music, but copyrighted material, period, right? And because I know a lot of things that we do, and like when I think about, you know, Martin Luther King's birthday or some other very significant days that come up, or dates, and I mean, that's just...
This is the impact of this is going to be primarily on music, because the way in which Sound Exchange, which collects this money, is set up, is to take that money, and these are for sound recordings of copyrighted music. So this money is going to be funneled back to the record labels, and then, in theory, the other half go to the performers of course, it's not clear that the performers will do any better under this arrangement than they've done under the ASCAP BMI arrangement, where you have to be pretty phenomenally successful in order to recoup the cost that you owe the record company who's produced the work before you're entitled to any royalty. In fact, that, to my mind, is the kind of the simplest and dumbest problem with this, is that this decision assumes that the people who produce the record, the recording companies, are entitled to a multiple of what the artists are entitled to. I mean, the artists are represented by ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, and those rates are much, much lower.
So you're saying it won't affect the...
No, it won't. It
okay.
won't.
Primarily music.
This is going to be affecting music.
Okay. Mary, then Rob.
I just want to kind of make sure I have this right. It's going to be calculated no matter what your content is. If you have nothing but talk and maybe a total of 20 minutes a day of little bumper music on your rate of 218 listeners per hour on a monthly
right.
basis.
If you're doing
but
that...
But nothing on... Let's say we have a station like that that's doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing that they put on except this little filler music is
right.
going to be charged. I mean, there's nothing chargeable
there. That's
right.
It's possible.
So how much, let's say, I play 45 seconds of a music break, and then I do this 20 times a day. They listen. I'm not being charged by how much of that content. I could play the same things continuously all day, and if my stream is over the 200... then I would pay the same rate whether I played 20 minutes of music in 24 hours or 20 hours of music in 24 hours. Have I got that right?
No,
I hope not.
Well, every single song, regardless of whether it's repeated or not, is going to be treated, if it's a copyrighted work.
Right.
A performance of that song, whether you put them all together or string them out across the day, that's
going to
count.
What if it's not a complete performance, as often it isn't?
Yeah, that's one of the hard questions is, when it becomes a performance of a work. And there are provisions in the DMCA for the use of ancillary work,
mm-hmm.
but the distinctions between when it's ancillary to another work and when it's a performance of work, we don't have a bright line test. So I couldn't tell you that 20 seconds
of a three-minute
song is not a performance. It may well be.
So there's no that is not defined.
We don't yet have a standard for that.
Is there a way to affect the setting of a standard for that? In other words, do we have any avenue there? If that's not been set, other people, there's going to be a huge number of people who need to know this, like, we all know that.
The problem
do
is...
Do we have any avenue there to do anything?
Maybe. What we're, I think you're wading into here is the whole issue of fair use.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fair use doctrine is designed in part to let you use pieces of copyrighted work, including music, without infringing, provided it's used for purposes of commentary or parody or other creative uses. But those standards, as anybody who's tried to work with them will tell you, are useful. It's easy to see what they're intended to do, but very hard to apply them because you can't, no court has ever said more than 10 seconds or 10% of a song is unfair use. Because the standard varies with the nature of the work, whether you can infringe a poem much more easily than you can infringe a novel.
Does fair use still apply? They haven't stricken that.
No. Fair use is alive and well, and is an incredibly valuable tool, and would be in the very situation you mentioned, perhaps a decisive defense. But it makes lawyers nervous because they can't answer good simple questions like yours. How much is too much?
Rob and then Michael.
Sure. Thank you very much. John, the currently we pay through CPB composer royalties for the music that our stations play. Under the copyright royalty decision, webcasters and other digital broadcasters will have to pay performance royalties. I guess, and this sort of relates to many of the other questions, in the event that it's determined that Pacifica stations are not exceeding the aggregate tuning hours that have been set by the Copyright Royalty Board, we will still have to pay the $500 annual fee to keep FM broadcasting the way we are now.
Right. Yeah, what you're calling the composer royalty is relates to the musical work.
Correct.
And that's ASCAP, BMI, and CSEC.
Right.
This Copyright Royalty Board decision doesn't affect that. You still have to pay that.
Right. But webcasters and other people will have to pay.
They still have to pay that.
An additional performance royalty.
Right. And both of them are actually performance royalties. They just relate to different works. One relates to the performance of the lyrics and notes, the musical work. One relates to the performance of a sound recording,
right.
A particular recording of a musical work.
Right, but record companies wind up getting paid twice, but that's not the issue. That's not the issue.
It's part of the issue. I mean, I think that's a fair issue to raise as part of this decision that, you know, the record companies are making out like bandits here.
Sure, but I mean, that was not really the thrust of my question.
Sorry.
My question goes to if a station or if Pacifica begins streaming musical content, then the concern becomes whether or not we are exceeding the aggregate tuning hours permitted by the Copyright Royalty Board decision. And what's not clear, I guess, is how it's going to be calculated, at what point a station's internet streams or internet streams and other things are in excess of the 159,410 hours.
Right.
Secondly, if, for example, a station or the network were to begin putting together multiple streams of program content, which included commentary and non-musical stuff,
right,
as well as musical stuff, the definition of what a channel is also at issue now, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it would be, because you're going to have to track each separate stream or channel separately.
Right. So the way to be safe, I guess, is if Pacifica or its stations begin internet broadcasting or looking at other digital stuff, and podcasting is different because podcasting is by nature something that's already been downloaded.
Right.
So the copyright issues are much more strenuous for broadcasters. But the issue then becomes, if you don't want to be subject to these additional royalty charges, the tendency will be either not to stream music programming, or the tendency will be to develop programming in which you have already negotiated the licenses with the record companies. And so obviously one of the ways for us to go is to develop our capacity to license material from particular artists, mm-hmm, and particular record companies that we're likely to want to air on Pacifica airwaves. But more importantly, one of the things that we can also do is to develop PodSafe music libraries in which we have live performances by artists who have given Pacifica or the station or the producer permission to continue to broadcast and redistribute those things. And that's one of the directions we're trying to go to right now. But I guess the buildup is, it seems to me that there are two areas of opportunity for us. One is to explore developing training and tutorials that we could conceivably even share with other non-commercial broadcasters,
mm-hmm,
because in the discussions that I've had with other station managers like Cephas Bowles from WBGO,
mm-hmm,
in Newark, New Jersey, nobody has good information about how to easily go about licensing. And secondly, the interest in PodSafe music libraries that are used by non-commercial broadcasters is going to increase exponentially. And as we know, FMU got $400,000 from the Rockefeller Musical Philanthropies that distributed the money from the suits against BMG and Sony.
Mm-hmm.
And they're developing a pod-safe music library of their content. So I guess what I'm saying is what we hope to be able to do with your guidance in the future is explore becoming more effective at licensing content from artists and from record companies that want access to Pacifica's audience, and secondly, to move forward quickly to develop these libraries of musical content that we have license to and that we can license freely, on our internet broadcasting. And share with other people that believe the same way we do. So that's where
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think the wrong response to this is it reminds me of people who've planned their entire financial life around avoiding taxes. You don't want to have to plan your life around avoiding paying a copyright fee, like not playing music or some strategy like that. The direction you're talking about is essentially creating an alternate world where you either have the licenses and you don't need the record companies and this statutory licensing scheme at all. You're just opting out of that because you've got direct licensing. Or you have a system set up where licenses have been cleared, a Creative Commons approach where people can go. And the only drawback to that system, and FMU is the only one I know who's really pulled it off on a broadcasting mode, it's a big undertaking. I mean, it's a major rights management problem. And I think FMU has licenses from over 400, 500 labels. Yep. Wow, that's a lot of work.
Michael?
Well, thanks, John. This is really informative. Let's see. I have a couple of questions. Pretty simple ones, I think.
Good.
This is a...
At last.
I couldn't even understand what these other people were saying.
We gave a panel of lawyers gave a seminar at NFCB on intellectual property stuff, and it very quickly becomes just totally incomprehensible, jargon-laden. Somebody came up to me at the end of the hour and a half session and said, could you tell me what you all said in the last hour and 20 minutes?
And you politely said no.
That's how I feel.
Go ahead.
This is a per station fee. I'm assuming any station that streams will pay the $500. All right.
Yeah, it's really a per site, per channel fee. So because it's set up not only to capture performances by broadcasters who stream their broadcast signal, but just a pure webcaster. I mean, lots of college folks that just have a web radio system. They're going to get nailed, too. Yeah, okay. But it'll be, for your purposes, you can think of it as a per-station cost.
And then this may be not so simple.
I suspect it.
This requires vision now. I don't think that this really affects us much now because we don't stream anywhere close to the numbers they're talking about. They have to pay more than $500, and I pause to be corrected.
You're not correct. Okay. KPFK is definitely at that level. KPFA as well, yeah. Some of our stations are at that level, and if you project forward very shortly, if we're doing what we're talking about, which is using this space to do new programming, we'll be well over it. This is going to affect us.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, I think, my setting all the math problems aside, my major objection to this is that this is a major deterrent to using the net as a way of distributing program.
Do you think that's accidental?
I mean, that's where the future is. Everybody.
But I'm not going to add. My next question would be, well, how much is it going to cost us? But
and that's that's basically what I think the strategy of public broadcasting entities going back at this will be is to say, look, you know, you didn't listen to anything we said. We're set up here to operate on a totally different model than commercial broadcasters. The only model that will make sense for us is not a per-performance scheme, which is designed to match what a perfect hypothetical marketplace would do. We don't operate in a marketplace. We're driven by mission and by, you know, other motives than making the maximum amount of money out of this. The only scheme that makes sense for non-commercial entities is some kind of flat fee basis. That will let experimentation rule. Maybe you need some kind of cap on that, but it's not the cap they've imposed, which looks back to, I think, data from 2004. They used data that was put into the record years ago as to what the average NPR stream attracted, and used that to come up with this magical threshold number. And that's just not going to help you grow.
Did you have more, Mike?
Well, I didn't get to, since you answered my question that I paused, I didn't get to actually sandwich my complex point here, which is how would you see this affecting, you know, what Pacifica is doing? How would it affect us with what we potentially could create? It's wide open, I know, but...
Well, I think there are the two main problems is that, one, it makes you feel guilty to succeed. And two, or at least you have to be nervous. And two, and I think this is a point worth belaboring, particularly for small stations, is that this is at least until some kind of magic software comes along, this is an administrative nightmare. There are going to be stations out there with two or three full-time staff who are not going to have to hire somebody to count songs.
But you mentioned that YouTube software. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, there may one day be a software fix. I just was mentioning to Dave earlier that one of the things that this YouTube case is going on the TV side now. And one of the things I just read this week is that YouTube is saying they've developed software that will capture and detect the use of any copyrighted material. So they'll be able to determine whether or not if they post something it'll constitute a potential infringement or not. Maybe equipment like that, software like that, will come along and eliminate this problem. But until it does... this is a real human resource problem.
And speaking of that, it's a good segue into my last question, which is, I know this isn't parallel. I don't think it's parallel, but YouTube and MySpace were up. Were they opposed to this particular kind of decision?
This doesn't affect. Right. This probably doesn't affect them directly. This is geared toward primarily music-based internet sites.
Rip and then John had something else. Oh, Rip, Bob, and John. Mm-hmm.